Welcome to the Recruiter Startup Podcast. This podcast is sponsored by Luxo. It's also sponsored by Sourcewell and Bold Identities, three products we use in our own business that have been tested by our RecWired community. And that's what we like to do. We like to promote and help the different brands out there that we know work in recruitment businesses. And we know that because we have our mastermind program where we've coached 70 founders this year. We have an advisory service, but we also have a community of thousands of recruiters that talk about their experiences. And these three products are absolute game changers. This podcast is actually to introduce the RecWired podcast. So Andy hosts the RecWired podcast. Andy Hall is my business partner in RecWired. It's one of the services that we offer recruitment founders. So that's our community where you can find out anything that you need to do to running your recruitment business, whether that's services, tech, international expansion, advisory, training, or just finding out what your peers are up to. And this goes from one-man bands to boutiques to scalable entities to publicly listed companies. We have them all in there. It's free to join, but you just have to be vetted by myself or Andy. So reach out to us if you want to come in. We've recently had our Christmas party where we had 130 recruitment founders and lots of great partners there. That was sponsored by Sonovate and CloudCall, and it was just a great, great event. So it's been a hell of a year for us all. In the UK, there's talk of restrictions coming in, but I think we're all building our businesses to be a bit more agile now, or so are our clients. So I'm still quite confident that this market's going to continue into next year. And, you know, I've been hiring internally and making sure everybody is on the right seat. So we've gone from just doing international RecDirect to doing UK and international RecDirect. So that's kind of one little element of our business. We help provide virtual assistants, so virtual recruiters from Eastern Europe, from Philippines, into recruitment firms, and we have them on contract to a lot of our clients at the moment. We do advisory with our mastermind, and Charlotte also does some bigger business advisory where she goes in and streamlines tech and operations and just gets the finer details done. We have a new product coming out that is back office solutions for recruitment firms. So that's headed up by Siobhan Kelly, and she helps find L&D professionals, talent acquisition, finance, operations, everything that's non-sales in recruitment firms. She also does talent acquisition for other businesses as well. So what we're trying to do is to have a full service for recruitment founders where we can really help them scale their business. And personally, I'm going to jump back in and do a lot more RecDirect this year. I spent last year building out all the different services and products and making sure our team are all on the right seats. But I'm really, really just ready, and the business is ready for me to come in and just do recruitment again. And I'm kind of excited about it. Don't get me wrong. I might get a year into it and go, oh, I need to replace myself here and do the next thing. But sometimes having a bit of a break from the on-desk stuff really does help, like, get your motivation back for it. So this podcast is with Russell Clements. He's been there. He's done it. He is a recruitment legend. Andy knows him from their time at S3, where Russell was the former CEO. Look, he's well known in the industry, and he's going to be getting lots more of these legends on his RecWired podcast, as well as our premium partners. This podcast is sponsored by Bold Identities, by Luxo, and by Sourcewell. So if you want to find out more about any of those products, or you want to have a bit of a chat about your tech stack or anything, just hit us up. You want to join RecWired, again, just reach out to me and we'll add you straight in. Hopefully I get a chance to have a chat with you if you're a recruitment founder about how we can help you out next year. Super excited about where the industry's going and all the work that we've done in the last year. And I hope you share my optimism that the market is going to explode and we are all in the right position to take advantage of it, because the hard work is done. You know, we're ready for the remote world. We've all built more agile businesses, more tech savvy businesses, and you know, it's all there for everybody to go out and get. So Merry Christmas. I think this will probably be the last one that I'll do. I'm going to try and unwind with beer and food mixed with a bit of exercise to keep me ticking along and make sure I don't lose the run of myself. Hopefully you're all in the same boat on that. And we will be back again in the new year. If you want to come on the podcast as a guest, just reach out to me and we can make it happen.
So a treat of a podcast. I get to interview one of the original members of the S3 gang, and but not talk too much about S3, talk about what he's up to now, his observations around RecTech, successful exit, successful Series A, and also the ones that maybe weren't so successful. Also the parallels in the Covent job board price hikes, and also his view on the market. So very excited to introduce Russell Clements. So welcome to the Required podcast. Instead of going to our drinks tonight, I'm stuck in Cape Town, but that has given me the opportunity to do this podcast with the recruitment legend that's Russell Clements. As many of you will know, Russell Clements was one of the first employees at S3, joined the first day at S3, the same day as Alex Ferguson, and arguably had a more illustrious career. One of the most interesting things about Russell is since leaving S3, he's actually completely reinvented and gone on and done some really exciting things. So, over to you, Russ, who, tell us what you've been up to since 2012.
Well, thanks, Andy. It's almost 10 years, so that's a long period to cover. But I mean, in essence, I've done two things, really. I've done some non-executive work, and I've been an angel investor in a few, rec tech type businesses, which I've also chaired in the most cases. So it's been a kind of combination of non-executive and or investor, all really still within the recruitment space, either as recruitment companies in the sort of, you know, the traditional sense or tech businesses that are looking to address that particular space. So I've stuck with the theme of the last 30 odd years.
How was making the adjustment? Because when you were S3, it would have been 3,000 people, multiple across the globe. And then you go and work with people like Dan at Cube19, who, you know, are starting from a very low base, you know, literally proper startup.
Well, I suppose it helped that when I joined what became S3, I became the second ever employee, and that made four of us in one room. So actually the irony of it is most of the businesses that I've advised or invested in up until this point have been bigger than the business that I actually joined that became S3. So, I mean, having gone on that journey from small startup to, a successful global business, and having been involved literally on every step in that period from the smallest to the largest sort of thing, obviously you learn lessons that you can then hopefully help other people. I mean, when I say learn lessons, probably you make mistakes that it's useful to make sure that other people don't make the same mistakes. That's as much as you value as anything else. But I think if I'm honest about the two times I've most enjoyed my time at S3, it was probably when it was a very small company by the standards of what it eventually became, and when it was a big company. And when it was a big company, there were big strategic, you know, challenges. It was a publicly listed business, etc. I probably lost in the last probably decade of my career there any real kind of mentor type relationship with most of the people that I work with. And so what I realized was that was something I'd really missed without actually necessarily realizing it at the time. So being involved with smaller businesses gave me back something that's probably been absent from, you know, a decent chunk of the latter part of my career. So I've really enjoyed that.
One of the things I really like about being an advisor is you have the gift of being able to go in, go out. And, you know, the thing that perhaps I didn't like in the end of the corporate life was all the meetings and all the structures and all the standing orders and all the procedures. Whereas actually the great thing about, you know, that sort of advisory world is you can just go in and be very specific and then, you know, come back in a month's time and see what's happened and then, you know, do that for a number of organizations.
Yeah, I'd agree. I mean, the one thing I would say is that, you know, I have had the experience with one or two of the businesses that I've been involved with where actually, given their size, they should have been a lot more agile than they actually were, which was a bit of a kind of an eye opener for me. You know, I look back at it now and I think if S3 was the sort of proverbial ocean liner, it was actually a relatively nimble ocean liner. So if I've had a frustration at all, it's been, well, you know, if we could make major change in reasonable timeframes, you know, why the hell can't you? Bearing in mind that, you know, you're a fraction of the size. So that's been that was probably a bit of an eye opener. I was a bit surprised about that. There's perhaps examples where there was no bureaucracy, there was no sort of, you know, big machine that needed to be turned around. But nonetheless, for whatever reason, you'd get involved in a conversation, you'd agree some outcomes and then come back, you know, a month or 2 months or whatever later and think, well, it's not been done, you know, so and why not? So that's been a little frustration. But yeah, you're right. I mean, certainly it doesn't have anything like the stress levels that it does actually having a full-time job.
Yeah. So how do you go about picking what's a good rep tech investment? Now, we only ever hear about the good ones. So I'm sure there's been a few less good ones along the way, but in your 10 years of picking horses, what do you look for?
Well, the first thing is a general principle. I'd start by saying what I've never backed, and I've never backed what you might call is a disintermediation play. And there's a predominance of those, you know, out in the marketplace, you know, essentially variations on the, you know, we don't need recruitment, the world doesn't need recruitment companies. Here's some technology that will replace them. Probably a good analogy for that was how cynical I was about the early purported success of Purple Bricks. You know, because that was a classic disintermediation play, albeit in the property market. And I've seen that done before, attempted before, you know, and it failed in recruitment. And I thought it was only a matter of time before it failed in a state agency, which it appears to be doing. The only unfortunate thing is I'm not the kind of person that shorts stocks, because if I put my money where my mouth is on that, I might have made a few quid. So I wasn't interested in businesses that were looking to replace recruitment consultants. And that wasn't out of principle. That was out of a deep belief in the fact that it's a fool's errand. But the businesses that I've backed by and large have been around the idea that you can use systems and technology to improve the productivity of a recruitment consultant's job. So that's what they've had in common. And then the other critical thing is that I've actually both trusted but also rated the people that were behind those businesses when they came to me.
I remember when you it was actually in your little corner office at Great Portland Street. You were telling me you were investing in Hinterview. I think I'd met Dan and he literally
had Cube 19, not Hinterview at that stage.
Sorry, Cube 19. So and he was saying, I remember the phrase because Dan had just shown me this dashboard. And it looked like Sky Sports, and it turns out it was Sky Sports because I think he literally had ripped it off Sky Sports. But this is going to be on television screens all around the offices. Look fantastic. But I remember your phrase. You're like, I'm backing the jockey.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And that is more important than anything else. I'm absolutely convinced of that. I think the other thing about Cube specifically was that, obviously, as you know, we spent millions over a very extended period of time to essentially have the kind of analytics and the kind of dashboards that Cube was really sort of pitching as being, you know, more or less, you know, just add water. And so I think from that perspective, it was consistent with the philosophy that we'd had at S3, which was the absolute value adding potential of systems. And we backed that, you know, to the tune of huge amounts of money, large numbers of people. So again, I suppose it was a continuation of something that I genuinely believed in. You know, I didn't need to be persuaded about the underlying rationale for the product. So that's important as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that I think S3 was famous for was that management information, that ability to make decisions. I think you probably even saw that in the last pandemic where, you know, very much from the outside, you know, everyone asked me, what's S3? What's S3 going to do? I said, well, if they sort of go to form, they'll wait a month, they'll look at the data and then they'll act. And I think that's pretty much, you know, what they did. But to be able to have that sort of analysis, you've got to have that sort of core data, and you've got to invest in it, not just from a, we'll put the technology in, but from a just a belief that this is what we do, this is how we measure things, and this is why it's important. So you have to create that culture.
So, and I was going to say that's one of the some of the companies that you think they buy a system like Cube, they're going to magically, you know, import that culture. And obviously you need the philosophy, you need the value, the belief in the power of information to begin with, in order to make that worthwhile investing in the first place. So, you know, there's a symbiotic relationship. It should make that easier for you. But you're quite right in saying if you've got a culture that doesn't value information or data, then buying a piece of technology isn't going to magically, you know, solve that problem for you.
Okay, so we've had an exit for Cube 19. I see on LinkedIn today that hints of you have just done a Series A for 3 million. So you're clearly getting good at this. Who's next? Who should I be putting the required dividend reinvestment into?
First and foremost, all the credit really goes to the management teams in both cases. And that's not false modesty on my part. That's absolutely a reflection of who's actually been who's done the heavy lifting in that sense. These things, as you say, you have some successes and you have some failures. I mean, it's in the nature of backing small businesses that you've got to go into it with your eyes open, and you try and mitigate the risks by the stuff that we've already talked about. But you've also got to be philosophical about the fact that, you know, not every to your analogy about the jockey, not every jockey's going to win the national kind of thing. There are a couple of other things that I've looked at more recently. There's a business called Candidly, which is, you know, very much a sort of startup in the rec tech space. Again, run by people that I used to work with, people that I know and trust. That's the latest example of where I put a bit of money in, with a view to both backing the individuals, but also backing the philosophy and the idea behind the product. And no doubt there'll be others in the future, because one of the reasons why I've stuck with this is, you know, as Warren Buffett says, you know, kind of invest in companies you understand, you know, in markets that you know. And I've pretty much followed that philosophy. If you then add, you know, and then back people that you personally know, then you'd hope you're actually, as much as you can, you're enhancing your chances of actually backing a winner. But at the same time, as I said, you know, there's no such thing as a one-way bet.
So back 10 years ago, you were buying this tech. I remember when we were negotiating with the Oracles, the SAPs, the sales forces of the world around these big deals. And now you're on the other side of the fence seeing it. Do you feel bad being a purchaser? Because I certainly do. I remember the hoops you used to put people through. And when I've been on the other side of the fence, it's horrible.
I've never been head of sales for any of these businesses, so I've never actually had to do that. But I think the, you know, if I look back at, you know, the dealings that we had with the likes of Oracle and SAP, you know, when you're dealing with a business of that size, you know, even if you're a substantial business in your own world, you know, you're never going to be that significant to Oracle, SAP. They'll tell you that you're wonderful, and then, you know, they won't take your phone calls the minute that you've actually committed to the software, right? And I think SAP was a great example of that in particular, actually, out of the two. Whereas the businesses that I've been involved with are actually much smaller businesses addressing much smaller companies. And one of the things that I like, you know, if I put myself in a position to think about being a salesperson for a Cube 19 or for a interview, one of the things I like about the recruitment market as a place to sell into is the fact that you're typically selling to the person that's got the authority, they've got the budget, you're selling the headache pill to the person who's got the headache. And that's actually pretty unusual in this in the 21st century now, is to not have to go through a million different layers You know, it's almost the old fashioned sort of sales that, you know, we got involved with, you know, when we first joined recruitment companies and got excited about, was the fact that you could make a difference in a very straightforward and manageable kind of way. And I think that's gone for a lot of people. You know, you're throwing CVs into an RPO black hole or whatever. Well, you know, selling a rec tech solution to the recruitment market, I think would be a really exciting sales opportunity. I can think of a lot of pluses for that marketplace from that perspective.
I must admit, recruiters do love being sold to as well.
Mm. Absolutely. And you know, it makes a big difference when that person can see that and say, well, it's not a question of, in an abstract way, if I can save your corporation $1 million, you know, you might get a pat on the back and you might get promoted. If, you know, if you can say to someone, I think I can see a way clear to make £100,000-£200,000 more GP for you, they're going to see most of that, you know, if they're a typical sort of, you know, smallish recruitment company.
Okay, so that's RecTech. History's repeating itself, it seems. So I don't know how many recruiters here are renegotiating their job board deals at the moment, but we're hearing some horror stories about renewal prices up, I think, 300%, 250%. You know, no one's in for less than double by all accounts. And by all accounts, the usefulness of the job boards is going down as well. So response rates and a candidate short market. Sound familiar?
Well, it does in one sense, because obviously jobs are famously held the market to ransom. I suppose the big difference back then was the fact that they were pretty much the only game in town. I mean, the analogy that I used back then was the fact that, you know, it was having a village with one pub in it. And a landlord that had the propensity every now and again to bar you just because you know looked at him the funny way or walked in the cracks in the pavement kind of thing. So I guess what we did back then, as much as possible, was we built our own pub, or at the very least, we helped other people to build their own pubs. We weren't comfortable about being so dependent on a very limited supply chain. But I guess the one thing about that is that what you couldn't argue about is the fact that JobServe worked. You know, yeah. So, you know, the reason why that person had that amount of perceived bargaining power at that particular point was that because there was no doubt that actually it delivered. So it's an interesting one. If you're on the one hand, you've got a supplier that is not delivering as it was and is simultaneously asking you for twice or three times as much money, you know, the classic sort of supply and demand equation, the buyer seller's market equation, would suggest that, you know, they could ask, but, you know, are they going to get away with it? Yeah. And if they do, then is that a paucity of imagination on the part of the buyers that they haven't got other alternative ways of getting access to the candidates?
You see this as well with, I mean, they certainly haven't got the market domination. You're going to think that LinkedIn with their recruiter accounts pretty much got that sewn up. And it's an interesting one. I play this game with my advisories, and especially if they're very heavily into LinkedIn, and say, for example, it's 4,000 a seat or whatever. Okay, do you still give everyone a seat if it's 5,000, 6,000, 7,000? What's the elasticity of how Yeah. long you'd have to go before it breaks? And Mm-hmm. I think LinkedIn's still away from that. Probably shouldn't say that publicly because someone at Microsoft will put the prices up again. But there is such reliance on that. That again, it's I think to use your analogy, LinkedIn's probably the only pub in town. If you took that pub away, there's a whole generation of recruiters that could they work?
I suppose the difference between LinkedIn and a job board like JobServe is LinkedIn is almost a kind of ecosystem, isn't it? You know, it's almost a social media. It's got, you know, a multiple elements right to it, whereas, you know, at the end of the day, what was JobServe? It was a way of actually accessing candidates on the marketplace, and in probably 80% of cases they were candidates we already had on our books. But it was easier, certainly from a recruitment consultant's perspective, to put a JobServe ad out and get the candidate to put their hand up and say, hi, I'm looking, even if they could have found that person on the database anyway. So I think there is, you know, in that sense, you can't strictly compare the two. I think you're right. JobServe's dominance in one respect, I think, was greater because it was an early adopter. It was the best and one of the only things in its class at that stage. I think a lot of this, on the other hand, is about habit, right? So to use the job serve analogy, one of the things you'll remember perhaps we did was we were told constantly by the recruitment consultants, we only get good candidates through job serve. So when we were trying to broaden the range of sources, we still had this idea that, you know, the only decent candidates came from job serve. So what we did as a tech solution was we anonymized the source, so the recruitment consultants couldn't tell whether it was a job serve response or it came from CW Jobs or whatever it might be. And Kel surprise, it turns out that job serve wasn't quite as amazing as people thought it was. It was a selection bias thing. So I don't know. I mean, it's a challenge, I think, more generally. You were the LinkedIn generation. I think the biggest single challenge facing people running recruitment companies at the moment is how do you manage that generational difference between, you know, the gen, I'm probably borderline baby boomer, Gen Z, and Gen X and the Gen Ys and the Gen Zs. And that's got on multiple different dimensions. I think the most topical one right now is the working from home thing. But one element of it will be, you know, you've got generations of, let's call them LinkedIn jockeys, training LinkedIn jockeys. So of course, yeah. You know, there is no great surprise in the same way that everyone thought job serve was the one and only way to do recruitment at one point, or the only way to get candidates. You know, there might well be an element of that with the job serve situation, with the LinkedIn situation. Don't ask me what the alternative is, because I don't know.
The big observation actually I've had over the last sort of 2 years that I've been in this new world for me, is the profile of people that are starting their recruitment businesses is very different. I mean, traditionally, you know, it was people with 5+ years experience. They generally managed a big team, even got to director. You know, they built a business. So they'd done it all on their someone else's ticket. They felt confident if they did it. You know, we're seeing people with 2 or 3 years experience, you know, sometimes not even that well trained, and they're going out, they're setting up, That's the thing, because if your firm doesn't build a database, then you're basically you've got the same tools as someone who could sit there in their bedroom, you know, LinkedIn jockey, to use your term.
Yeah, but I think you've made a very good point there, because, you know, I was involved in a lunch some time ago, and it was a bunch of people that, you know, ran their own small recruitment businesses. And we were talking, I mean, the topic actually, for what it was worth, was recruitment and retention. You have actually done this for someone else. You know, how many of you have been in a situation where part of your day job was trying to solve some of the same problems that you're currently trying to solve with your proprietor hat on? And I guess probably half the people put their hand up and said, yes, they had. I would probably discount half of them as basically being bullshitters. So you might have got a quarter of the people that were there had actually done it before. And there's almost this sort of magical thinking, which basically says, somehow, if I say I'm the boss, or I am the boss because I own the company, that the universe will somehow furnish me with these competencies and skills and experience that I actually haven't got up until now, you know. And it's absurd, really. I mean, why would you? It's like a good footballer magically thinking they're going to be a great manager, you know, because they were a good footballer, you know. So I couldn't agree with you more. I think there's a hell of a lot of neophytes, you know, that it always was a market with low barriers to entry.
Yeah.
But it's become even more so.
Yeah. And I think the interesting thing is that people now are learning in different ways as well. So actually, you can actually come from outside of industry. We've seen that before, you know, but people are now getting their training on the job. So they're actually learning to, you know, to become great recruiters, become managers, and they're actually doing it in flight, as opposed to your point. They've not actually done it as part of their job elsewhere. And that's difficult as well. It adds risk. And, you know, the question is, I guess it's one of those, you can't prove a counterfactual, but would they have got there sooner if they'd have maybe waited 3 years, done that, got the experience, and then gone in and did their own thing? It's an interesting discussion. Well, but the barriers are so low now, I agree.
I mean, I've never done an academic study on it, but I suspect that if you did do a piece of analysis, you know, looking at the data, and looked at, you know, the kind of average amount of experience someone had when they set up their own business, I would think there would be a, and then let's say their 3 to 5 year success as a proprietor, you know, as an owner, I suspect if the starting point is already, you know, a decent amount of experience, then the trajectory for success would be, there'd be a positive correlation. I'd be incredibly surprised if there wouldn't, if there wasn't. But again, that plays into, doesn't it, that whole generational thing. I want it all, I want it now, you know, so it's part and parcel of that.
Is it a generational thing? Did people always want it now, always want it, but it just didn't always seem that possible before?
Yeah, I think that's probably true. But I think if you know, I can think of people that came to us and basically after 2 years said, well, unless I'm a director next week, you know, I'm off. And we were like, see you later. You know, so it was like, you know, that was our point, you know, that in the end, you know, you accepted the fact a certain percentage of people left, set up their own businesses. That was, you know, that was part of the landscape. But you're right. Generally speaking, it wasn't people that had been with the company for 5 minutes. Those people are the ones that buggered off and said, I've been offered more money elsewhere. I've been offered a better car, you know, whatever it might be. They might have left for a better car. Now they'll be saying, you know, we're setting up ourselves, you know. Yeah. So I mean, you know, you had challenges about retention. That's nothing new. But I guess, and actually, ultimately, you know, most companies created their own long-term competition, but the time frame has probably come down substantially.
Yeah, 100%. So, last but not least, the state of the market. We've talked about it. We've brushed about it. Is this the best market you've seen in recruitment?
No, I don't think so, because I've been around long enough to have seen genuine, you know, kind of mad markets. You know, I don't think you'll ever get anything quite as crazy as the dot-com period. I mean, actually, for absolute just pure demand, then before that you had the Y2K thing. So I suspect they were, in most senses of the word, better markets even than what you've got currently. I mean, what you have got unquestionably is extraordinary levels of demand. But I think there's an element of that. You know, has it gone to such an extreme that actually it's dysfunctional? You know, because ultimately you don't want to be in a position where you're, you know, you can be like the ticket tout outside Wimbledon, right? You've got no shortage of people wanting 2 tickets for men's finals, right? Okay, you demand, your challenge is supply, right? How many men's a pair of men's tickets for finals day have you got to sell? You know, so that's really the question. You know, you certainly want a seller's market, but you don't want a seller's market to the exclusion of being able to do deals.
So on the basis that history repeats itself, what can anyone who wasn't there for .com and wasn't there for Y2K, what can they learn from this market? What should they be doing that's perhaps not obvious to them right now?
Well, the only observation I think I can make on that is that, you know, when things are doing fantastically well, people think that's the norm and that's forever. And it's the same when things are going very badly. So extremes tend to be, while you're experiencing them, recalibrated as a new normal. You know, this is going to be the market forever, you know. So I think the first thing to say is, no, it's not, right? Abnormality is by definition not typical. Normality is typical. In terms of what that means from a practical point of view, I suppose the way it probably manifests itself in the, you know, anecdotally at the moment, is people sort of throwing money at the problem of trying to hire people, you know, and just thinking, you know, if I throw enough shit against the wall, it will stick. And while there's definitely an argument which says, quite rationally, that generally speaking, if you've got twice as many recruitment consultants, you'll make quite a lot more money than if you had half as many, there's still an argument which actually says that's a bit of a one-dimensional way of looking at the world. So I would encourage people to look at real yields. I would look at, you know, when there's a very common thing here where people will say, on average, we're doing X or Y.
Yeah.
And actually, when you say, yeah, but what about the mode? not just the average. How much of that number is being driven by, you know, the top three or four people in that team of 10 and the other five or six are doing pretty mediocrely? And you become less analytical in a better market. You know, there's more money around, you think. So I would just say that, you know, be mindful of the fact that you should still be looking at the quality of the performance. And is that driving a rationale for hiring rather than a simple, you know, let's divide the number of the amount of GP by the amount of consultants, and that looks pretty good. Actually, what's that distribution look like? And you'll remember, Andy, when we were at S3, one of the things that we had was systems that very much looked at that. And the hiring now was quite sophisticated. It wasn't just done on a simple average.
Yeah, I think that's important as well, and actually fully understanding that. And I think there's a, when it's all going well, you know, people are in that bubble and, you know, they don't think that it's going to end. And actually, I think, you know, we probably saw it into the credit crash. You know, if we'd have actually probably looked at our data a bit more, you know, I think credit swap, you know, our securitization desk didn't have a job coming for 3 months. We probably could have predicted the credit crash if we'd have actually looked at what, you know, what the market was actually saying. So, but because it'd been an amazing market for 3 years before, then we're fine with it. We keep plowing on. It will come back. Rather than, I guess, actually looking at it with very cold eyes and saying, what are the fundamentals behind this as well? So yeah, I mean, I think as important as riding that wave is knowing that when that might stop as well and not being the last one in there.
I think the other thing to say is that within any market, whether it's a good market or an average market or a bad market, you will have a massive distribution of relative performance. You know, some people will do better than others. So there's always room for improvement, you know, whatever it might be, whatever the underlying market is, you know, it's not like everyone does universally well and everyone does universally badly, you know. So within that, that's about execution. It's about doing things better, et cetera, et cetera. Look, I think for most companies, most small companies, you know, that there's an argument, well, what's so bad about making hay while the sun shines? You know, I mean, that's probably how people are thinking. I think if you've got a larger organization, certainly if you've got, you know, as we were a public company with external expectations, you then have to be a bit more sophisticated about it. But you know what, if you're a 10 person recruitment company, you know, you might as well just knock yourself out. It will end at some point, but you know, you might enjoy the ride. Yeah, exactly.
Okay, that's great. I mean, so what does the next year hold for you? Yeah, if we had this conversation in a year's time, what do you think you'll be doing over the next year?
Not a lot different, I don't think, really. I mean, I'm happy with what I've got at the moment. I mean, it keeps me busy, but not so busy that I'm precluded from doing other stuff. You know, certainly interaction that I have through being involved, advising, doing the investment stuff. You know, if the alternative would be playing not very good golf with a bunch of other 50 something year old retirees, then I'll stick with what I've got. But there's definitely a limit to how involved I want.
So just lost you there just at the end, Russell. So we'll pick this back up in a year's time. You might have better internet in Norfolk, or is it North London or Ibiza? I'm not sure.
That it's actually Norfolk, and ironically, the internet here is normally better than it used to be in London. So,
yeah, fair enough. Well, look, thanks so much for taking the time. It's always great to catch up and hear what you've been up to. Obviously, a breadth of knowledge, breadth of experience, and always great to catch up. So, thanks, mate.